This podcast is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening to our podcast right now. You might be driving at the same time, cleaning your house, maybe exercising. But what if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Zendaya Plays Doubles edition. It's Wednesday, May 1st, 2024. On today's show, Challengers is the new feature film from Luca Guadagnino, he of Call Me By Your Name fame. This one stars Zendaya as coach, muse, lover to two male tennis players who are childhood friends and rivals. And then the TV show Baby Reindeer is a huge hit. It's on Netflix. It's about a young up-and-coming comedian and his very entangled, to put it mildly, psychodrama with a so-called stalker. It explores themes of sexuality, masculinity, and abuse. It's a true-ish story written and directed and starring Richard Gadd as his own alter ego. And finally, what is a magazine? The question arises in the aftermath of something called High Snobiety, which I didn't know about until I prepped the segment, I'm ashamed to say. Anyway, something called High Snobiety won a National Magazine Award for General Excellence. This prompts the question, is it a magazine? If it is, what has a magazine become? If it's not, what was a magazine? We'll hash it out. But first, joining me today is Julia Turner out in Los Angeles. She's a fellow at the USC Annenberg School for Journalism. Julia. Hey.
Hello, hello.
Dana Stevens is the film critic for Slate.com. Dana.
Hello.
Great to see you. All right, let's make a show. The director, Luca Guadagnino, broke very big with the movie Call Me By Your Name. He returns now with Challengers. It stars Zendaya as a dominant junior circuit tennis player who, due to a catastrophic injury, must become now a coach instead. Along the way, she has been acting also as muse and idealized love object to two equally young and up-and-coming male players, Art, played by Mike Faced, a fresh-faced ginge with talent to burn, and Patrick, a dark-eyed hustler and ladies' man, played by Josh O'Connor. What follows is I think it could be described as a classic sports melodrama crossed with sexual intrigue and ambiguity as only Guadagnino can deliver it. In the scene we're about to hear, Zendaya's character Tashi waxes poetic about tennis to the two other corners of her developing love triangle, Patrick and Art. Let's listen.
Hitting a ball with a racket is a great way to avoid having a job.
Well, that's also your problem, because you think that tennis is about expressing yourself, doing your thing. That's why you still have that serve.
It works.
Yeah, but you're not a tennis player. But you don't know what tennis is.
What is it?
It's a relationship.
Is that what you and Anna Miller had today?
It is, actually. For about 15 seconds there, we were actually playing tennis. And we understood each other completely. So did everyone watching. It's like we were in love. Or like we didn't exist. We went somewhere really beautiful together.
All right, Dana, let me start with you. The movie won the weekend, and the audience that I saw it with was very alive to the material. That's all I'll say right now. I want to know what you thought of it.
I mean, I loved it. We can get into whatever quibbles one might have, why it might not be the deepest movie of 2024, but it may be, along with Love Lies Bleeding, which was another early 2024 movie that got my pulse pounding. This is maybe the most fun I've had sitting in a movie theater all year. And the audience was also going crazy when I saw it. So we can get into why that is. But I mean, just as filmmaking alone, I just thought this film was so viscerally effective. I'm not a sports person, as has been talked about many times on this show. I didn't go in particular excited about seeing a love triangle set in the tennis world, although the actors intrigued me and Guadagnino intrigued me. But this movie makes tennis so sexy. It manages to weave together the sports part and the, you know, romance love triangle part of the story so effectively, just in terms of cinema, the editing, you know, the way the ball is framed as it moves around the court. We can get into this, but I think my favorite thing about the movie cinematically, the way the time frames all fit together, right? Because this is a movie that operates by a series of flashbacks. We start in 2019 in the middle of a tennis match, and the rest of the movie is essentially going back and moving back up to this moment in time to see what is at stake in this tennis match and why it's so much more than, you know, who hits the ball better. And often to me, in movies that rely on flashbacks, especially successive time frame flashbacks, there's a sort of dutiful expository sense to the flashbacks. Like, all right, back we go again to the boring past to figure out why the exciting future has happened. But all the time frames, I felt like, were very suspenseful and beautifully kind of layered together, so that when you get to that last game, which I think we're going to talk about full of spoilers in our Plus conversation today, by the time you get to that last game, you know how much is at stake at every single thwack of the racket.
Mm-hmm. Julia, the movie certainly, I would argue, makes tennis sexy. It makes sex sexy in an unapologetically Hollywood way. Dana says, beautifully framed balls. What do you say?
Literally, there's a lot of male nudity in this movie, even though it's not that sexually graphic. I mean, there's so many steam rooms full of totally naked dudes.
Beautifully framed balls. I mean, as I said. Julia, what do you think?
This movie is so much fun, and it made me realize how seldom Hollywood now makes things that are smart and dumb at the same time. Like, usually they make things that are dumb things pretending to be smart, and this is a very smart, smartly made, silly movie. You know what I mean? Like, it's basically just one long filmed encomium to lust and hot people through the lens of tennis, and it's very witty and it's delightful. And, you know, what I love about it, and I think Justin Chang noted this in his New Yorker review, is like, it recognizes that lust and desire doesn't just happen in the scenes with the clothes off. You know, there's plenty of scenes with clothes off, as we've noted, but the kind of tension and desire and competition and rivalry and friendship and all of the other things that can add up to lust and desire are so beautifully layered throughout this really nicely nested portrait of these long-term relationships and rivalries. And the whole thing is ridiculous, but delightful. It's my review.
Oh, I'm completely, completely with both of you. I mean, so not only was the audience that I saw it with alive to it. I mean, I'm now, like, I go to a, like, you could argue, a hipster movie theater in Brooklyn to watch movies with an audience. And I'm like the old guy in the movie theater. I'm not the, you know, ancient, but whatever. I'm, you know, whatever. I vocalized my response at one or two moments in this movie. I just, what she says, Zendaya says something to Josh, I said, ow, out loud, and everyone around me laughed. It was such a sick burn. I couldn't help it. And so a couple things. One is that I, like, went in having utterly forgotten if I ever knew who directed the picture. So I'm sitting there watching it thinking, okay, this is sort of a dumb, fun movie. It'll be a dumb, fun discussion, a smart, dumb, fun conversation with my co-hosts or whatever. I was like, wait a second. This movie has layers to it and odd nuances and psychosexual, you know, shadows, like dark, like there's some darkness in this film. I was like, what the fuck am I watching? So you're right, Julia, it's like the smart, dumb movie delivered perfectly. Funnily enough, I thought I actually had pacing problems the first 5 minutes or so, and I was like, I'm not going to enjoy this at all. Then about 20 minutes in, I'm like, this is the single greatest airplane movie ever made. And 45 minutes in, I was like, this thing's fucking Citizen Kane. I love this movie. it's so good. Among the many things I liked about it is it's funny, tart. It has an element of cruelty to it, the cruelty of sports and the cruelty of male friendships and of lust and of a rivalry and romantic rivalry. Of course, all of its energy comes from the sexual allure of the sexiness, the genuine sexiness and smart sexiness of the stars. These are intelligent, ambitious young people who kind of know who they are, which is really interesting to watch. We don't feel smarter than they are at all. They're brilliant about tennis. I actually thought much of the tennis, though, as it goes OTT by the end of it, is very well done. Julia, you're right. It captures something that I think the best movies not based on familiar IP used to be able to do, often in as few as 90 minutes, capture important lapses of time through the art of condensation in a human life. So even though you're only sitting there for an hour and a half, you feel as though you've witnessed an epic or mini epic EPOCH in the life of a real human being, which is an extraordinary thing to be able to pack into that amount of time. And here's my biggest takeaway. Because the movie is so unapologetically centered on a woman who knows herself, who's intellectually the equal or superior of the men, was the better athlete, is lusty and openly lusty and confused about her sexuality, they allowed the boys to be boys and the men to be men. We have covered so many movies that I admire the shit out of in the last 15, 16 years of doing the show. Over that time, masculinity's crisis has deepened to the point where it's very hard for people to know in good faith how to depict heterosexual, male heterosexuality on and rivalry and friendship on screen without an aura of either over-assertion, like over-compensatory self-assertion or cringing apology. And because of the way the triangle is balanced around Zendaya, who's extraordinary in the movie, that was one of the better depictions of male friendship, which is rooted in, you know, homosociality as it bleeds into other kinds of yearning. Romantic rivalries is the love object that both men supposedly yearn for actually a substitute for one another? Is it a way of them bonding with one another? The depth of male love and its confusions as it takes place within a purportedly heterosexual friendship was actually depicted, I thought, with astonishing depth of feeling and nuance. I thought it was weirdly in its own way. Dumb fun, dumb smart, however you want to call it, it is a crowd-pleasing movie. It's a surprisingly good film.
The one thing I would contest about what you just said, Steve, is that it's a movie only about heterosexuality. But I do really appreciate that this is not, and I say this in my review of the movie on Slate, it's not the story of two closeted gay men who are channeling their love for each other through
this.
You know, right? I mean, the triangle is a real triangle that goes all three ways.
No. Absolutely. That's the whole point, is that we're all on a spectrum, right? Or some kind of a continuum when it comes to our sexual longings, right? And men, especially, I think, when you're in a locker room, like there's male sexualities playing off of male sexuality, right? Regardless of how people self-identify, this movie is really smart about that.
Yeah. I mean, I also love the portrait of adolescent male friendship and the specific time frames depicted here that's basically from like 18 to 31 or something like that, that we're getting to know these people. And that sort of evolution from the inexperienced, fervent lustiness of adolescence to the sort of, I've decided what my life is going to be, I think, of your early 30s, like the portrait of that evolving relationship to lust and desire in a person maturing and growing up. Yeah, it's smart. It's smart as hell. And it also made me think about just how sexless movies have been. Like, when's the last time you saw a sexy movie? You know, like there's either no sex, there's just banter in place of sex and then cut to black, or there's sort of sex as something dark or sex as trauma. I mean, it felt unapologetically interested in the complexities of desire without suggesting that they're pathological or problematic or positive, or, you know, it was like neither sex positive nor sex negative. It was just like, sex, here it is. This is a factor in these people's lives. And then let's just tell an entertainingly ripping yarn about it. It was refreshing and fun.
I do have a counter to you. Where has sex been in movies? And it's the movie I mentioned earlier, Love Lies Bleeding. But I suppose you could argue that the sex in that movie is purely pathological. Even here, though, as I think Steve hinted a little bit in his initial description, there's like a kink at play at Factor, right, in the threesome, in the sense that Zendaya, clearly her character, Tashi, clearly wants to orchestrate, right? She wants to be in charge and puts herself in charge. And in fact, if I had one critique of this movie, I think, well, it's three critiques, really. It's that all three of these characters are a little bit game pieces, right? It's a very fun game that Guadagnino is orchestrating with them. But I'm not sure that we completely understand the motivations of any of these characters outside of the one motivation they've been given, right? In her case, to kind of orchestrate these two men's lives through tennis and sex at the same time. In fact, because her character has been sidelined from being able to play professional tennis, right? She is entirely motivated by moving them around like game pieces. So I guess that makes a certain amount of sense with the way the story goes. But yeah, this isn't the most psychologically complex movie, I would say, but it makes everything clear via the, you know, the actual machinations on the tennis court, what they all need and what they want and what they're withholding from one another.
But didn't you feel like the acting, I agree that maybe as a piece of writing, the psychology is not fully rounded, but as three lead performances, the acting makes up for it to me. Like the, I mean, Zendaya, you know, to say that Zendaya is amazing in this year of our Lord 2024 is to say that the sky is blue. But to watch her, although actually there were a couple critics who did not enjoy her performance in this, but the sense of like caged prowess, or, you know, the rage and dismay and need to refuel her power or rechannel her power after the injury. Is, I think, so powerfully and subtly portrayed. And that tension and tautness in her performance is great. And then, I mean, one of my favorite moments, there's a moment late in the film, without spoiling it, where after this decade plus of rivalry, the boys just start to play tennis with kind of boyish competitive glee and the delight on their faces as they do that. I don't know. I thought all three performances were so strong that they kind of made up for some of the mechanistic chess piecery of the script.
Totally agree. The three performances totally elevated. And I have to shout it. I feel like Mike Faced is my personal discovery, because I remember seeing him in Dear Evan Hansen when he was a teenager. He didn't play Evan Hansen. He played the, if you know the show, the kid who at the beginning of the show dies and sort of sets the whole thing into motion. But then he sort of comes back as a ghost on stage. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I remember noting specifically that he was an incredible dancer in that show. And then when I saw him as Riff in West Side Story a couple years ago, not knowing it was the same person or even remembering the actor's name, I thought, Riff really dances like that kid in Dear Evan Hansen. And sure enough, it was him. So, I mean, he's a very physical actor. His background is in doing Broadway musical stuff. And so even though he doesn't really have the physicality of a tennis player, and neither does Zendaya, they're sort of too slender and Hollywood beautiful, they convince as tennis players on the court.
Yeah, I find them very believable. All right. Well, the movie is Challengers. It's in theaters now. I will note that it is MGM, a.k.a. Amazon, so it'll be streaming on Prime soon enough. But really, 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 it's fun to see this one in the theater. So go check it out.
When daring young ladies played tennis in the gay 90s, the mode called for grass courts and ankle-length costumes. Now tennis is taking on a still newer look. There's only one trouble. In a mixed doubles match, how will a poor male be able to keep his eye on the ball?
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season two is out now from Lemonada Media.
All right, before we go any further, Dana, this is typically where we discuss business. What do we have this week?
Steve, there's but one item of business. It's to tell you about our Slate Plus segment. Our Slate Plus segment is a throwback to a thing we haven't done in a while, I think, which is a spoiler segment on the movie we're talking about. Because Challengers, the tennis love triangle romance, is such a twist-based movie, there's really no way to evaluate it without talking spoilers, especially the ending, the sort of final game that we see played on screen, which has an inconclusive but very exciting ending. So for Plus this week, we thought we would get into all the details, tennis and otherwise, of that ending for those who have seen the movie or who either don't want to see it or don't care if they see a movie that's been spoiled. If you're a Slate Plus member, you'll hear us do that at the end of the show. And if you're not, you can become one by going to slate.com/culture plus. When you're a member, you get unlimited access to all of the writing and all of the podcasting on Slate.com. You also get ad-free podcasts, so you'll never have to hear me read an ad again. And you also support our work and the work of our brilliant colleagues. These memberships matter a lot to Slate, so please sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. Once again, that's slate.com/culture plus. Okay, onward.
All right, well, the TV show Baby Reindeer has been dominating the Netflix charts. I mean, it's been at number one, I believe, for a couple weeks now, on and off at number one, maybe. It's based on the true story of Richard Gadd, who wrote it, directed it, stars in it, Phoebe Waller-Bridge style, as his own alter ego, Donnie. Like Fleabag, the piece started out as a Fringe Festival monologue. It concerns a struggling young comedian who takes what seems like a superficial shine to a woman who wanders into the bar where he bartends, only to have her insinuate her way into every cranny of his life. But did he secretly want that to happen? The show stars Jessica Gunning in a tour de force performance as Martha, his dubious superfan. I should say also the title, if you haven't seen it, is Martha's nickname for Donnie, the lead character. In the clip we're about to hear, bartender Donnie, played by Gadd, is now being digitally pestered, to put it mildly, by Martha, played by Gunning. He agrees to meet her for coffee to try to clear the air. Let's listen.
Wow, that is some laugh.
Yeah, I get that all the time. Chuckles Buckles, my dad used to call me.
Well, Chuckles Buckles, do you have a volume dial? Can I turn you down a bit?
You'd have to turn me on first. So, are you serious about me? I can take it. Just be honest. Be ashamed, though. Obviously, what the... with the curtains, get my hopes up. But I'd work through it. I'd work through it.
Yes, I'm serious about you.
Oh my God. Wait, as a friend, okay? As a friend.
Friends. With benefits.
Just friends.
Julia, let me start with you. I mean, this is, first of all, it is a huge, huge hit. Like, it's kind of a viral peak TV style hit. I know a lot of people who are having blood pressure problems watching it. They find it not cringe almost. There's a horrifying, very intense and emotionally demanding element to this story that massively complicates the relationship between these two, you know, protagonists, antagonists. What did you make of this rather extraordinary piece of TV?
It's incredibly constructed. And I understand why it's a hit for Netflix, because even as I would not say I enjoyed watching it, which does not mean I didn't like and admire it, but it's, you are full of dread as you watch it. The quality it instills in you is dread, and it's not the kind of fun release dread of the horror movie, which as our listeners know, I don't find fun, but lots of people do. It's like maybe tapping into the dread of people who like to read about cults or the mentally unstable. I mean, stalkers are kind of an interesting topic, but you're full of dread. But because the format is essentially a half hour drama, and because the plot twists and turns are so dense, it has this quality of what's going to happen next, cliffhangerism within the dread, that keeps you propelling through the next half hour, the next half hour, the next half hour. So it makes sense to me that it is such a phenomenon. And I'm so curious to hear what you guys made of it. I admire it. It's been compared frequently to Michaela Cole's I May Destroy You, in that it is a young comic creator performer's record of sort of sexual abuse and its manifestations in their experience of the world. And I came away less sure whether what this project is doing with its dark and compelling material is great than I did with I May Destroy You. Like, I can't quite tell if the current of lurid dread is what's carrying me along, or whether some smart, sophisticated processing of all of that dread and abuse is what I'm getting from this project. So I feel a little confounded by my response to it, which mixes both admiration and a sense that I'm not entirely sure all of the material here has been fully processed into something new. What did you guys think?
I can't wait to hear Steve on it because I know he's seen the whole thing, which I haven't. I do plan to finish it because, like you said, Julia, it has a very propulsive quality. Even as you might not be 100% behind what it's doing, you feel like I have to hear what happened next. And unlike many, many American TV series about this length, it feels like the right length to me. It feels like each episode does something new and addresses a new part of the story. I sort of wish I'd seen this as the one-man show that it started out as at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And then I think it went onto the West End and won an Olivier too. I think because Richard Gadd is so compulsively confessional, you know, the person who I thought of, actually the performer I thought of, was Lena Dunham, who has a similar mm-hmm. kind of exhibitionist quality. You know, she can't help but reveal too much and sort of almost wallow in the abjection of revealing too much, but also find the kind of cruel humor toward herself in that abjection. He has that same need to exhibit. And that must have made the one-man show even harder to watch in a way, because you're hearing it from the mouth of the person it all happened to. But the dramatization of it does not always work for me. The story itself is so jaw-dropping, and we won't get into all the twists of what happened and the various flashbacks, etc. But the story itself is so jaw-dropping that you're kind of nailed to the screen. But I agree, Julia, there is a somewhat unfocused and unprocessed quality. I don't think it's near the show that I May Destroy You was in terms of its dramatic construction. But it certainly mines some of the same territory and has a similar sense of you almost seeing something that you weren't meant to see.
Mm-hmm. Well, I loved it, which means I liked it considerably more than you guys. Let me try to explain why. First of all, I think it gets better as it goes. Much of what hit me funny or askance and made me wonder how I felt about it, I mean, dread is overwhelming. Anybody who watches it is riveted by a set of feelings that aren't necessarily comfortable to sit with. But it also tends to make you compulsively watch the next episode. So, you know, we watched it in a rush in my household. Here's what it reminded me of wasn't I May Destroy You, which is a fucking masterpiece and very little lives up to it. I wish more people had seen it. But Fleabag, in a way, just because it so clearly originates in a monologue, it's so obviously built upon the deeply felt life experience of the person who did the monologue and now stars in it and is under has overwhelming artistic control to bring that vision to the screen. And here's what I also really liked about it. At first, my largest objection to it was, I'm not sure this isn't fat-shaming. Jessica Gunning, who plays the lead, is notably a large woman, right? It is clearly a choice. It is a very, you know, a conscious choice on the part of Gadd to cast someone who looks as she does. And secondly, mental health shaming to a degree. She's clearly an ill woman. She's portraying an ill woman.
But his character does seem to know that and feel
yes.
for her in that way.
No, absolutely. But at first you don't really know that. And he feels very victimized and very passive. And as the show goes on, both of those things become enormously complicated by his own quest to try to understand how he brought about this nightmare reality, what role he played in it, and where his need to have her affirm him and have that level of attention from another human being actually, in a way, in a perverse way, a very deeply fucked up way, invited this woman into his life, even though she is, you learn this very on, this isn't a spoiler, is in the process of destroying it. So, and then the second thing I would say is, her performance is astonishing. I mean, it is one of the best performances I've ever seen on television. Her face, because what's so heartbreaking about it, it's not, yes, it's the dread that this woman may destroy this man's life, but she's sick, she's not well, and she needs something from him that goes so deep to her damaged core. And she brings all of that onto her face in the most human way, the actress Gunning. And there are moments when she looks at him, because there are moments when she looks crazy and she's just malevolent, and one would think of her only in terms of a inexorable, almost natural force like a hurricane that might flatten your house, right? But there are other moments when the utter humanness of needing and the depth of her need for his attention and approval back, it is so utterly heartbreaking, right? So she portrays this person as an utterly real, vulnerable, and in many ways sympathetic human being. But then the other thing I would say is that we're leaving out what a substantial part of the show is actually about. It's about Donnie, Gad's characters, on again, off again, in very troubled relationship with a trans girlfriend who he cannot fully understand his own attraction to her, and he can't screw up the courage to actually be her public boyfriend. And even though he clearly loves her and she clearly loves him, or they're in the early stages of a relationship turning into a serious romantic relationship. And it's that impediment that he's trying to get at in relation to the neediness that he displayed in the face of this potential stalker and his relationship to a mentor who badly abuses his vulnerability in that relationship, like in ways that are very extensively depicted is all I'll say. I don't want to spoil it, but are very, very powerful and also heartbreaking. So there are three really human, heartbreaking relationships. And then it ultimately is a story. I mean, not unlike the other film, right? It's about the fragilities of male heterosexuality relative to the performance of male heterosexuality that men feel is demanded of them. And so it was yet another, to my mind, like almost shocking portrayal, shockingly honest. It was like Knausgård really was, you know, it was Fleabag meets Knausgård to me. And that was hugely powerful to me.
Yeah, you are right that all of that complexity is portrayed and portrayed well and subtly and devastatingly with great performances and great pathos and pain. And yet there was something about this, even with the Fleabag comparison, I don't know. There's a scene in a later episode where his very shticky, arty, kind of anti-audience comedic routine is disrupted, and he kind of gives sort of a purging confessional monologue. And the whole show, despite its craft, despite the performances, despite how much is packed into it and actually how much I admire the density of the storytelling, had a little bit of the feel of that breathless rush to me. I will say that the final scene, which I won't spoil, perhaps relays kind of a thoughtfulness about how all of these themes stack up and how every character is, you know, processing their own hurt at all times and, you know, might play any kind of role in some other person's life as the person who does the hurting. And so, maybe I would have to see it again to appreciate all of the craft in it. But somehow it felt less digested as a series of traumatic experiences than Fleabag or I May Destroy You did. It felt like it was still quite raw, which is maybe part of its power, but also part of what makes it sort of unsettling and maybe in powerful ways less pat than some of those other examples we've cited.
Yeah, I think what you just said, Julie, has helped me to realize or just put in clearer terms what my main criticism of it would be. I'm very glad it exists, right? It feels like something that was important for its creator to make and is important, obviously, even just talking to you, Steve, for many of its viewers to experience too. But I don't feel that it quite works as drama. To me, it still feels like it's a one-man show that has almost, despite Jessica Gunning's extraordinary performance, it's nothing about the performers. There's something about it that feels a little bit like him moving pieces around. Second time I've said that in this week's show, right? But I think Guadagnino is a little bit more in control of his game pieces than Richard Gadd is with his characters. And I May Destroy You feels to me, when I remember it, like a world. I believe that those characters exist in a world and have a relationship to each other and a history. This feels a little bit more to me like one person's psychological trauma being sort of reenacted by external figures.
I think this is really interesting. And I just wonder how much this is a gendered response. And let me quickly just say why, which is because I don't think you guys are wrong. That is not the point I'm making. It's almost the opposite, that, you know, we're at a confusing moment for men who want to try to tell their own story, right? Especially if you are you know, privileged according to the received categories of race, class, and gender, right? Those of us who agree completely with the direction of a post-Floyd and post-Me Too world will only tell our own stories advisedly and with the notion that it probably isn't our turn to speak. But we still carry around our own biographies and our own misgivings and life misgivings and ambiguities. We're lugging them around in our guts still. And at a certain point, one has to try to find a way to express them, whether in art or not. And the question of how is like a really live one. And this week we watched a movie where like kind of unabashedly like male young men were depicted kind of the way I remember being when I was between the ages of 18 and 32, right? That tender point where you're no longer a boy, but you're really not a man. And trying to figure out who you are in relation to other people and what they'll let you get away with, right? I thought that was remarkable. I felt like I hadn't seen that in a while. And so for me, this is like kind of like Knausgård. It's like our inner lives didn't go away, but we owe something to the fact that for 50,000 fucking years, men have been monologuing at the world. Privileged men have been monologuing after the world, at the world, you know? And so I admired it maybe more than it deserved. I mean, I was quite taken with it because it just struck me as an honest attempt to say, yeah, we're carrying around a lot of fucked up, dark, confusing things. And we want to tell the world for the same reason any artist wants to tell the world what's going on inside them. And I didn't feel as though he fell back into any of the reactionary or overcompensatory or condescendingly overly accommodating traps. Anyway, that was what I felt about it.
That's so interesting, Steve. I mean, I think I almost... I like that as a theory of the case and as a way of framing your own response to it. I guess I felt like this narrative was packed with so much dreadful incident that it almost felt the opposite to me, like the dreadful incident is what gives him the right to have a story to tell, like only because he's suffered these newsworthy bad things can he tell the story of struggling to find himself as a person. And the moments in the final scenes, the later scenes where he does begin to reckon with the aspects of his own identity that maybe don't have as much to do with these dreadful incidents. And in particular, a beautiful, beautiful scene with his parents is worth, I mean, that is extraordinary, an extraordinary moment. I mean, there's so much to admire here. I would not tell people to swim against the tide and not watch this show. I'm just trying to digest why I found it so gripping and yet also felt something missing. I mean, maybe the lack of digestedness in it just means it'll be interesting to see what Richard Gadd does next.
Hear, hear. All right. Well, the show is Baby Reindeer. If you haven't seen it, check it out. And this is one of those ones where shoot us an email. I'm just so curious to know how people are reacting to it. All right, let's move on.
Back in the 90s, Pepsi and Coca-Cola were in a heated race to try and win loyal customers by any means necessary. But when Pepsi launched an ambitious promotion that encouraged people to buy Pepsi and redeem points for prizes, they overlooked their own fine print in a major way. On each episode of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop, comedians join host Misha Brown to chronicle one of the biggest pop culture fails of all time and try to answer the age-old question, who thought this was a good idea? Like, who at Pepsi thought it would be a good idea to advertise that people could earn enough points to redeem a military jet as a prize? When they launched their Pepsi point system, they never imagined somebody might try to actually snag it, but a 23-year-old did, and suddenly, Pepsi owed him a jet. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
as I understand it, a magazine, it's like a metaphor, right? Like a gun magazine, right? It's like you kind of put a bunch of things into a single unit. You aggregate them together. A magazine is an aggregation of a variety of individual sensibilities under a single loose but recognizable umbrella editorial sensibility, right? So if you write for The New Yorker or Slate, they obviously are hiring Dana Stevens or whomever because they want the Dana Stevens-ness of Dana Stevens to shine out, but they also are going to subordinate it in various ways to their own editorial vision, right? That's the way a magazine works. So you collate it together, you print it, and you sell it. And like all printed matter, magazines are under existential threat from the digital revolution and have been now for close to 20 years at least. Enter High Snobiety, which started in 2005 as a sneaker blog. It evolved into a website that covers fashion and youth culture more generally. It's now... what exactly? I mean, that's actually the discussion here. It's enough of a magazine, however, to have won the most coveted award in magazines, the National Magazine Award for General Excellence, no less. Julia, you've forgotten more about this subject than I'll ever know. So why don't I punt it to you? What do you make of all of this? What do you make of High Snobiety? What do you make of magazines and the state of magazines? Talk us through it a little.
Well, I should start by saying that I'm a longtime National Magazine Award judge and actually a member of the board of ASME, which is the American Society of Magazine Editors that oversees those awards. So I love those awards. They are hard to win and they reflect the collective esteem of roomfuls of very, very smart magazine editors. I was not party to this particular award, but, you know, it's always a wonderful experience to convene with the smartest magazine editors in the business and look at all the work that's being produced in any given year and figure out who's doing something really interesting and fresh and new. So it's exciting that this interesting new project that is half publication and half broader brand company won this particular General Excellence Award. There are a couple different categories in which the group awards General Excellence, I should note. But the thing I've been reflecting on recently, and the reason I was interested to talk about this with you guys, is what is the future of magazines? There is a lot of conversation right now, and this is part of what I'm studying in my work at USC, around the embattled future of journalism broadly, of local news, of news gathering, of accountability journalism, of speaking truth to power, of investigative work. All so many forms of journalism are endangered, and a number of them have either outlets or nonprofits or various groups working to salvage and save them. But I'm not sure anybody's started the World Wildlife Fund for magazine journalism yet, because what magazine journalism is at its best and what its value is at its best is maybe more amorphous and harder to explain than keeping an eye on what the government is doing so they don't abuse their power, keeping an eye on what powerful people are doing so they don't abuse their power. Obviously, that kind of work can happen in magazines and does frequently happen in magazines. But what a magazine has historically done is something, I think, a little bit more, I don't know, evanescent. I'm trying to think of the right word. It's a little harder to define. And I think the way I would define it, but I'm very curious to hear how you guys would define it in the magazines that have been meaningful to you over time, is that a magazine, by its sensibility and the sensibility with which it presents and collects information, creates a virtual community and a sense that, like, this is a worldview that exists. And if you're a reader, you are among a group of people who thinks about the world in this way, wants to process it in this way, wants to entrust the editors of this magazine to kind of curate the world's information for you in a way that you find revealing, illuminating, useful, tantalizing. And that's a function that it's been such a privilege to be a part of in different ways over time in my career, but maybe it's also a function that's, I don't know, more easily replaced by the internet than going to the community board meeting and writing down what the, you know, local education council is doing. Like, you can find community on Reddit, you can find community on Ceramics Instagram. Like, I don't know. So I guess I'm curious for each of you to say what magazines have been to you, or what the value of magazine journalism has been to you, and yeah, what how you see that evolving.
I guess I'm in a confessional mode today, but magazines played a huge role in my sense of developing sense of self, because not only was I booted out of high school, I was booted out of college. And I had a period of years where I was outside of the formal education system. And even like the one that I, you know, two that I was in it, the last two that I was in it before being completely, you know, disjected from the meritocratic pipeline were in a zombie state. And I had an intellectually hungry mind and absolutely nowhere to place it, not nowhere to learn, nowhere to anything. And I subscribed to The Atlantic and The New Republic. This would have been in 1983. I read them cover to cover, and I scarcely knew anything I was reading about when I read them. But to me, it was the only way to be in the presence of an intellectual life. And you're, Julia, you're right. I mean, I can't even begin to tell you, when you don't have the physical brick walls of a venerable university and classmates and professors, even just to enter into that, you know, how to describe it. I mean, virtual smacks of the internet, you know, it was an analog physical object, but in reading it, you entered an imagined community is probably the way to put it, and felt like a participant in it, maybe, you know, a little bit deluded on my 19-year-old part, but it kind of kept me intellectually alive for a period of years. What I find interesting is the relationship between a degree of coherence of worldview that makes that imagined community seem real and meaningful to a group of people, disparate group of subscribers, you know, is curated by the editors, but also the eclecticism and variety of it. The whole point is that you have variety, as I said up top, like writers of various sensibilities being brought together under an umbrella. The difference between a magazine of the old analog kind and the internet day is that people search for something on the internet. They have a very specific thing. The community is much smaller. And the sense that you have a variety of voices, competing sensibilities, much less competing or antithetical political or cultural viewpoints brought together in the magazine, aggregated in the magazine, that's what will go out the window, even as communities, a sense of community is being created by the internet. That is a loss to me.
Oh, yeah. In a larger way, I mean, outside of the question of fashion magazines and how do magazines sell enough advertising to survive, which I think is somewhat what's at stake with the rise of magazines like High Snobiety, which comes out twice a year and costs $20, right? It clearly is an elite product for people who consider themselves to be sort of high snobiety snobs, you know, who are fashionista sort of, what's the word, connoisseurs or something like that. I guess my experience of magazines is a little more mixed, because I feel like, Julia, I think you would probably agree with me on this. As a young person consuming media, I'm not sure that magazines did me 100% good, as much as I think there was some psychic damage incurred in the fashion and women's magazines that I was served. And I grew up a little bit before you, Julia, so it was before the days of Sassy. Sassy became a thing when I was already a little bit aged out of the fashion magazine teen demographic. And so I subscribed to Seventeen when I was a kid, because that was the magazine that you got.
Oh, God.
If you were a young girl interested in fashion. And of course, all of the, you know, toxic information in quotes that it spewed about what your face shape was and what that said about the kind of hat you could wear, or whatever.
Oh, my God.
So embarrassing to have a body. Remember the like embarrassing stories things where it was like, oh, no, like, people would write in and be like, I got my period in an embarrassing location. And you'd be right. Like, what a terrible fun. Oh, God.
Yeah. And every ad had the same exact sort of sensibility. And I think that I grew up probably in the last decade as a teenager where that was not at all questioned. You know, there wasn't really any alternate magazine available to me. Right. And then I sort of graduated into things like Vogue and whatever those magazines were. I mean, I got Vogue up until I get it on and off still, you know, now, because I'll get some really cheap offer because magazines are desperately trying to survive. And I'll say, sure, you know, I'll pay $10 for a year of Vogue or something like that. But I would be perfectly fine with that kind of magazine dying out, honestly. I was thinking about the etymology of the word, Steve, when you started off talking about gun magazines, mm-hmm. which does come from the same, you know, yeah. ultimate source. But I was thinking about the French word magasin, which is just a store. Any kind of store you walk into is a magasin. Why is that? I looked it up before the segment, because all of them come from this Arabic word that then came through Spanish and French and various languages. It just meant a store. Originally a storehouse, like a big warehouse, right? So it's a place where you put things together. And that goes to the curatorial sensibility you were talking about, right? But it also means a store where you're trying to sell things. And the whole reason that High Snobiety is being written about and marveled at as this way that magazines might be able to survive is because it's a media company that somehow is a mixed, you know, magazine, but also kind of a store, like a catalog, you know, that presents these expensive objects that you can then buy. And I don't know. I mean, I certainly would not want the world to exist without physical magazines that you can pick up and read and look at pictures and have somebody curate a world for you. That is all great. But to the extent that that can only survive now in the digital age by becoming a store and blurring the lines more and more between commerce and editorial sensibility, I don't think that's entirely a great way for magazines to survive.
I love that you guys started with this definition of magazine because, you know, I grew up worshiping magazines and I did grow up in the era of Sassy. And I think Sassy, I mean, I was the daughter of two journalists, but if I had to say, why am I a journalist now? I would say Sassy magazine, like the experience of being spoken to and seen by a publication was so profound for me and really did feel like I did read 17 and YM and all the horrible, embarrassing period stories. But I also had this other voice, this like group of cool big sisters, you know, half of whom now have Substacks in their 60s that I still follow and still take fashion tips from, like being like, it doesn't have to be that way. There's another way to be a woman in the world. There are another set of things to value as a woman in the world. And your selfhood is not about what men think of you. And to just have a media property saying that now obvious thing was so important to me. But also like not necessary for the teens of today. I mean, when I think about where I get fashion information now, which is still valuable to me, I'm a student of design. I like thinking about clothes. I follow two newsletters from former Sassy editors that send me to different websites and keep track of who's making interesting stuff. And I read Blackbird Spy Plane, which we've talked about on this show, which is a kind of high-minded fashion and style and design newsletter from magazine writer and editors. And then I also see lots of interesting stuff on Instagram. And just as with Vogue, it's a mix of the ads and the editorial that display different styles that I'm interested in thinking about. Like, I don't know that I need a magazine to do that for me anymore.
Right. You're the aggregator, right? Like, you're the one who curates your world by taking from a Substack, maybe a New Yorker article. Like the idea, it just the way one reads even these venerable legacy publications, you know, the Atlantic and the New Yorker and the Times, it's still you kind of swoop in and then emerge quickly. You don't, you know, the old, you know, a old professor of mine used to call the old Sunday Times that brick, that giant brick, which was just the Sunday morning ritual, right? To get the whole thing, spread it out on the bed, Sunday morning, bagels and the Sunday Times. He was like, that's church. That's our church. That's our secular modern church, right? You happened upon things you weren't expecting and maybe didn't think you wanted until you happened upon them. That's totally, totally over. Julia, before we go, like, high snobiety, hold it in your hands, flip through it. Handsome is a magazine, I imagine. Something you'd seek out?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the return of print as the quarterly object, as the thing that you can browse, there are a few places that are trying to bring print magazines back in a certain way. And it'll be interesting to track those efforts alongside, for example, like the return of vinyl in the coming years.
All right. Well, if anyone listens to us as a reader, we'd love to hear what you think about it. But also, there's got to be a lot of like autobiography bound up in the old legacy experience of magazines, which it's true. I mean, it's just not reproducing itself in my kids. Zero. Not at all. So shoot us an email if you have some interesting anecdotes from that front line. Okay, let's move on.
Playboy reflects your appreciation of the total good life. It reflects your good taste in fashion, fun, fiction, and fact. You get first-rate reviews of books, movies.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening to this show right now are probably multitasking in some way or another. You might be driving, cleaning, exercising, maybe grocery shopping. But as long as you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing right now, and that's getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you can save money by doing it right now from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
All right, now is the moment in the podcast when we endorse Dana. What do you have?
All right. Well, as listeners know, I was in England since our last show. I've been to London and back and spent just 4 days there. Had a wonderful trip with my daughter, who was there doing her final audition at RADA. And the whole trip was really, really jam-packed with great Englishness. And I came back with so many London-specific things to endorse. But since not everybody can scoot off to London right after hearing this, I'm going to endorse something British that we can all access. And it's actually a show that I sort of hope we talk about on this show. We did discuss doing it when it first aired in the U.S. early in April. But there's this four-part British show from ITV called Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. Have either of you heard anything about the scandal or the story of this? So it's an extraordinary dramatization of a true story about the British post office system and a scandal that's taken place over the past couple decades in that system that has to do with, I'm not going to probably explain this right, but the British post office system is, you know, not only about delivering mail, but it's a sort of banking system for the country. It's a place where you go and pick up your pension checks and things like that. So these British officials, sort of bureaucrats called sub-postmasters, are big figures, especially in small communities. It's almost like a sort of public bank that they run, right, where you can come and sort of get your mail, but also get your checks and maybe do some sort of official government banking. I'm sure anyone British listening to this is saying, you got it all wrong, but that's my impression of it.
I've read a history of this. This is exactly right.
Right. So that's the premise, or that's the sort of basis for the premise of the show. Now, what has happened over the past couple decades in this system is that a new software program, some sort of new computing system was implemented to help manage this banking around the country. And this software, as it turned out, was faulty. But the British Post Office was interested in covering up how faulty it was and instead wound up pinning all of these basically embezzlement cases on a bunch of these sub-postmasters, people who were running little post offices in communities throughout the country. And I'm going to not say the numbers because I'll get them wrong, but it was at least dozens, if not hundreds of people that were falsely accused of taking money that they had not taken. And in order to cover up for the fact that it was actually the faulty software, you know, there was basically a very large scale cover up, which was exposed in recent years. I'm not sure exactly how recent, but like in the past 5-10 years, specifically by this one postmaster named Alan Bates, like the English actor from the 60s, actually. Alan Bates is played by Toby Jones in this series. I haven't seen the whole series yet. I actually stopped watching it after starting in England because it was so good. I wanted to go home and watch it all with my family when I got home. But it's a sort of a combination of the British cozy mystery, right? Because we're watching this scandal unfold and seeing this very ordinary man from a small community start to figure it out and solve it, but also the expose of this horrific abuse of power on the part of this government agency. So it kind of checks a lot of those boxes. Like, I'm watching a cozy four-part show starring Toby Jones as a small guy getting, you know, helping the working man, but also really learning a lot about this system and how it was abused. So it's called Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. It's streaming in a bunch of places right now. I believe Amazon and Hulu are among them. I can't wait to watch the rest of it. So I hope people give it a try.
That sounds amazing. And I'm looking for a new show. Julia, what do you have?
I was going to try to be a fashion influencer, but I think the thing I was going to recommend is now out of stock. So I'm going to hold off on that and go back to my tried and true of being a recipe influencer. Have you guys ever made Samin Nosrat's clam pasta?
Mm-mm.
No.
But I love her recipes.
So if you have her book, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, contained within it as a lesson on how to understand and balance acids in cooking is clam pasta. And she uses it as a lesson in how to balance acidity As you kind of modulate the wine and the other ingredients in the recipe. And I made it once a year and a half ago, and it's like a little complicated. You got to buy clams and steam them and open up, and are they good and this and that. Like, it just feels like a production. But we made it again a couple weeks ago, and I realized it's the perfect thing to cook when an old friend comes to stay over, because it takes a minute to like get it all together, and there's bowls all over the kitchen, and you got to chop this and steam that and yada, yada. But it's sumptuously delicious and feels kind of like a magic trick, because clam pasta to me is just one of those things that you would order at a restaurant, but you wouldn't even begin to think about making at home. Maybe that is revealing of me as a cook. Having now made it twice, I think it's safe to say it was not a magic miracle when it was good the first time. It is consistently good. And if you have that book on your shelf, you should look it up. As with most things in that book, the recipe appears three times, once as a paragraph about acid, once as an illustration, and once as a recipe. We've been using the version that's written out as a recipe.
Scribbling it down, Julia, as I almost always do for your food recommendations.
Okay, so avid listeners of the show may recall that Julia endorsed the novel, latest novel by Zadie Smith. It's called The Fraud, right?
Yep.
Yeah, I thought so. And then a week later, totally coincidentally, I endorsed the novel The Blue Flower by Penelope Fitzgerald. As a listener emailed in to point out, in fact, Zadie Smith had just given an interview in which he said, I felt emboldened or inspired to write a historical novel because I had read Penelope Fitzgerald's The Blue Flower. Any guesses how old Penelope Fitzgerald was when she published The Blue Flower?
I don't know whether they guess old or young. I'm going to say
it's like 17 or 98.
Exactly.
Yeah. She was 79 years old, and she wasn't even all that far into her career as a literary novelist. I mean, talk about a late bloomer. I really didn't know this about her. There is a Substack, what do you call it, the post or whatever, by someone named Henry Oliver, called How Penelope Fitzgerald Became a Late Blooming Novelist, and how effectively she was not a writer of literary fiction. And she didn't publish a book until she was 58, didn't publish a literary novel until she was 62, and of course was going strong at 79. I mean, many people really regard Blue Flower as her masterpiece, or, you know, one of them, certainly. Anyway, it's this newsletter by Henry Oliver about Penelope Fitzgerald just does credit to the form. I mean, it's learned, easygoing, beautifully written, really interesting, and just taught me something I didn't know that was completely gripping, and we'll link to it. Guys, read The Blue Flower. It was really good.
All right. I'll read it if you read The Fraud.
Deal. I'd love to read The Fraud.
Okay.
Excellent.
Okay.
Dana, you went on this. You're just sitting there like poker face Dana. Like, fuck you and your fucking late blooming novels.
No, I'm thinking that's just always one of the most inspiring stories to me. Even the one I always tell, it's not nearly as old, but that Pauline Kael was 50 when she published her first review in The New Yorker. You know, her whole legendary career began in her 50s. And in many cases, I don't know if this is the case with Penelope Fitzgerald, you know, it's because she was raising a child as a single mother in the years before that.
Almost always, central to the story of women who suddenly, you know, quote unquote, bloom as writers in their 50s and 60s. Anyway, great show. Really fun. Thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Dana.
Thanks so much.
You will find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by the composer Nicholas Pertel. Our production assistant is Kat Hong. Our producer is Jared Downing. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.
It was famed Suzanne Longland who led a style revolt after World War I. And it appears that the game will never be the same. The girls like the new styles, of course. As a matter of fact, it's a love match.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.